This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Matt Robeson, Beyond Politics. And what would you say is the biggest threat to America today? You might be thinking weapons of mass destruction, terrorism, maybe even a broader threat like global warming. But what if I told you that many of America's senior leaders, especially the ones in the Democratic Party, believe that it's the insidious, intentional assault on our brains from people using technology to pump them full of misinformation and disinformation, and that those lies are making it harder and harder, maybe even impossible, for us to have a functioning democracy. And they're also putting some of the worst of us into power. After Donald Trump won the presidential election in 2016, a small group of leaders secretly started trying to trace how this web of distortion had operated, and even more important, they started trying to figure out how to fight it. The journalist Sasha Eisenberg is an expert in this world. A decade ago, he already wrote a classic on how technology is being used in campaigns called The Victory Lab. And now, his most recent book, The Lie Detectives, goes inside this new cutting edge of how technology is being used to shape our politics and our country, and what those lie detectives have found out about facing down this threat. Here we go with me and Sasha Eisenberg. So when I'm looking into a story, or doing an interview with an interesting, knowledgeable person like you, I usually have an, oh gosh, moment where something just really smacks me in the face and stops me in my tracks. In reporting out this book, what did you come across that just gave you that kind of, oh gosh, reaction? And as in, this is so bad, or how the hell does one defeat this?
I mean, I think that there was this sort of cumulative recognition on my part. As I was following these people who were on the sort of front lines of helping campaigns track and monitor and come up with tactics for responding to disinformation, I was following them for a year and a half. And I watched them grow more and more fatalistic about the work they were doing. And not because they thought they were doing good and important work. They thought that they were helping their clients, campaigns, parties, outside groups have some impact at sort of tracking and mitigating stuff, but they just saw the scope of the problem getting bigger and the relative value of the things that they were adding just feeling so negligible against this kind of overwhelming tide. And that was such a difference. I've been writing versions of stories about innovations in campaigns for, we're going on 15 years now. And I thought that's what I was writing here. And those stories, to me, to some degree, they've grown a little tiresome because there's like a natch to an innovation story. And that's true whether you're writing in politics or whether you're writing like in Fast Company about somebody who has a new startup to create the Uber of sourdough starter or whatever. And this person identifies problem, sets out to solve it, encounters some struggles along the way. And then eventually the reason you're writing the story is because they, to some degree, solved it.
It's Hero of a Thousand Faces, but for
this is a sort of narrative template. And in this case, I identified the people who were at the cutting edge and did have the best tools and approaches to addressing these problems. And the problem just got bigger and bigger. And there wasn't a moment where they felt in the least bit satisfied that they had accomplished anything worthwhile. And seeing that through their eyes was more revealing than anything I spotted, because this was new to me, but it was not new to them.
I want to read you something that just literally came in fresh this morning. We're recording this on April 19th, because it feels like this war on disinformation may be the most important story in the world. And the fact that we're losing this war on disinformation is the most important story in the world. So this is from Yale professor Tim Snyder's new post on his Substack that's fresh out this morning. He's an expert on Ukraine. Widely followed for his expertise there and on democracy versus autocracy. So here's what he wrote. I had the honor of testifying to Congress on the question of Chinese political warfare this past Wednesday, April 17th. This testimony was before the Oversight Committee, which has devoted months of time, money, and attention to an impeachment inquiry, which is based on a mendacious claim by a man in contact with Russian intelligence services. That congressional impeachment inquiry, based on a Russian fabrication, then became the subject of Chinese propaganda tropes designed to spread the lie that President Biden took a bribe. And then directly from that testimony, he said, democracy is in decline, dragged down by the autocratic lie. The autocrats offer no new visions. Instead, they lie about democracies and insert lies into democracies. The test of disinformation is its power to alter the course of crucial events, such as wars and elections. Russia undertook a full-scale invasion of Ukraine, on the basis of a big lie about Nazis. Even as we meet today, Russian and Chinese propaganda shapes House debates about Ukraine, the most important foreign policy decision of our time, in domestic politics, the most important matter in coming months and in the coming presidential election. When did you get the sense that maybe this is the most important story going on, the kind of thing that impelled you to write this book?
So I think there's a recognition after the 2016 election that this was, that something qualitatively different was happening. Look, to step back a second, some of what you read from Snyder, some of that's old. Nations have always tried to advance propaganda domestically and overseas. There's always been, in and around war, an exceptional embrace of tactics to mislead. Politicians have always lied. Certainly stretching the truth has been, it's the most tiresome joke about politicians that they lie. So let's acknowledge that a lot of that the introduction of falsehoods into politics or geopolitics is not something that started in 2016 or 2017. What I think happened in 2017 in the United States was a recognition that the media environment around which a lot of the basic assumptions of how political communication works was this uniquely 20th century media environment that was highly centralized, three TV networks, a handful of large newspapers in each city or market, some major radio broadcasters, some news weeklies, but you could see all the major circuits of information that we're getting to voters, do a decent job of tracking them and assessing what was out there, what the flow of information was to voters, and you could hold the speakers accountable. Made it very difficult for foreign governments to lie to your citizens in anything approaching a direct way. And look, there are examples throughout the 20th century of Moscow seeding Communist Party chapters in the United States, but it was the most circuitous, seemingly low impact way of driving public opinion, not the type of stuff you're talking about. And so the new decentralized media environment of the internet made it possible for all of these entities, foreign governments, but also individuals in their basements anonymously trying to sometimes not even affect a political outcome, just sort of sow chaos or have fun. People trying to make money off of clicks who don't actually care about their political impact. And if you're a campaign, the rule book, the playbook that you had for how you respond to these things is predicated on the idea that you not only could identify the speaker, but you could hold them accountable in our political process. So if your opponent lies about you, you turn it back on them and you say they're a liar if you think it's a problem. And you go to voters, and if you think the big newspaper published something about you that's unfair, you know how to push back because you know what their audience is. Now we're in this environment that where that's not possible. And that to me seems this, for the stuff I've been writing about for years about how campaigns communicate, seems this really transformative change. And I think that's
just seems like it published shifts
the geopolitical threat.
Yeah. One thing you write that you were just describing is, just to quote you back to you, is technology and deregulation.
Of quotation.
Yeah, you love the source.
Roger's thesaurus is insufficiently quotations. So I appreciate this, Matt.
So you wrote that technology and deregulation had together collapsed the distance between fringe sources and mainstream journalistic organizations. There's actually a lot. I'm not just blowing smoke here. There's a lot packed into that sentence. That's really what you're talking about here, is that if I ask you, hey, Sasha, what shifted during and after 2016? One thing that you were just saying is there was a technology shift. Clearly, the ability to directly access, to mainline into American brains from without, was fundamentally changed. And in fact, one of the things that a prior guest on this show, an expert on disinformation, now works for the Biden administration, Justin Levitt, said was, we have to remember that what was hacked in 2016 was not our technology infrastructure. It was us. It was our brains. Yeah. That's another aspect that I wanted to ask you about here, because you point out, as you start to detail this shift early in the book, you point out that it's not just the technology that changed. It's also us. You point to this well-documented episode where a Trump campaign operative says that we have three major voter suppression operations underway, gleefully tenting his fingers like Mr. Burns. Yes, this is excellent, right? And you've gone from, as you just said, a time where legitimate political communicators would fear blowback. This is, I'm again, quoting you back to you, from underhanded practices, from engaging in disinformation tactics. And now they're celebrating it. What extent was there also a psychological shift that happened in this time frame? How much did we change in tandem with the technology?
So I think I would disaggregate the kind of political elites from voters. I think the issue that's happened from voters is that there's been a weakening of almost all the institutions in American life that mediated expert knowledge into the public sphere, and that's helped guide people to understand basic facts about how the world worked. And so you look at all these institutions that, even when I was born, not terribly long ago, media institutions, academic institutions, scientific expertise, governmental, the FBI, the CDC, NOAA, these were all institutions, religious institutions that individuals trusted to make sense of the world for them, are all weaker in their public standing now than they were a generation ago. And so you have this void that has been created largely independent of the rise of social media, but social media has created these new, we literally call them influencers, but people who serve a similar function in the roles of people who follow them, who help guide them through a complicated world and without any real barriers to entry. And we had told a story about what that meant for politics roughly starting in the 08 period. That was a happy story, that social media was going to democratize aspects of the political process. It would let people participate faster and cheaper. That was a large part of the meta-narrative of Obama's victory in 2008 that we told was, wow, he was harnessing new technology to bring new people into the process, and people were registering to vote and making phone calls from home and sharing information and connecting with the campaign, and they didn't have to be mediated by political machines. And that was a story we told internationally about the Arab Spring, right? That one guy with a Twitter account who did not control a newspaper in Cairo or a radio station could tell people, come to Tahrir Square, and start a mass movement overnight without any of the traditional social political infrastructure that it would require. The flip side of that is you lower the barriers to entry to all sorts of other communicators, and you don't have any of those existing institutions. What I think has happened among political elites in particular, and I think that the Trump campaign official that you cite is this, but it's true of elected officials now too, is that there used to be, I think, a bunch of norms and incentives around at least being seen as a generally honest. And again, the joke about politicians is that they'll shade the truth and come up with a bunch of reasons why then every answer a politician gives is mechanically correct, but filled with all sorts of complications. But that's because politicians lived in fear of being called a liar. I think if you'd gone back 20 years and took a poll of people in office or running for office, what would you least like voters to think you are? It's to be called a liar. And I do think Trump, to some degree, by devaluing that term, by sending a signal to other Republicans that being called a liar by your opponents or the media isn't so bad, has devalued the sense among politicians that is, they see that as a cost worth bearing for the benefits that it offers. And I think among a crew of political professionals, the usual penalties that you would suffer professionally don't seem as urgent. And so I think people are just the norms, guardrails, whatever the hell we call them, but like, those were constraining the way political. There's no law that says you can't lie to voters, right? This is entirely enforced by sort of standards and norms, but there was a cost-benefit analysis that most people who wanted to have a long career in politics, whether as an office holder or as an advisor, consultant, operative, respected, because it would be hard to build a long-term career. People wouldn't want to work with you, give you money, whatever it is, if they saw you as fundamentally dishonest. And I think that's broken down.
I think the other factor, I agree 100% with that. And I think the other factor in it is not just a norm that people respected because it's, hey, this is an unwritten rule. Like in the NFL, at the bottom of the pile, you really don't gouge people's eyes out because that's not good. Yeah. But there was also, there was self-restraint based on a certain understanding of what was enlightened self-interest. There was an understanding among political operatives, at least a belief that there are certain lengths to which you should not go because you'd face blowback. And I've told the story on this show before that I used to sit in rooms when I was managing campaigns with political consultants, and sometimes tongue in cheek and sometimes really someone, maybe it was me, would throw out, hey, we should say this, we should do that. And some wise head with a touch of gray that I now have in spades on my own head would say, oh, no, you can't do that. You will face too much blowback from voters. Voters won't like that. They'll see it as going over the top. They'll see it as going too far. And that has clearly eroded. Now, I peg that back to one person, Newt Gingrich. And I think his fundamental insight was that was hogwash in the new media environment. Because you could get support for going over the top. You wouldn't get the tutting from Walter Cronkite that used to make you pay a political penalty with voters. And in fact, by moderating, you were underselling the effectiveness of whatever you were saying. All of that is not just to support your thesis, but also to point to one of the things that you do really well in this book is you frame it as, first of all, you employ the same device that all great writers do. Like this is the Michael Lewis, Malcolm Gladwell thing. You find a protagonist who's been avatar for the journey that the reader's going on here. In this case, it's Jory Craig, who's an operative who is, she ends up on a mission to change the mindset of fellow political operatives and take them out of the, hey, this is what we did 20 years ago to this no longer works in the modern digital age. And in fact, you have to throw a lot of your political playbook out the window. Tell us a little bit more about that insight, that journey, and what she ended up preaching. Let's take a break. We'll be right back.
Yeah, so she, what's amazing about her, she stumbles onto the American scene in 2017 as people are reckoning with this shift in the media environment. And there's a period after 2016 where everybody on the American left is trying to understand how Trump won. And there are obviously all the conventional lines of inquiry, what happened in the Rust Belt, what was Hillary's strategy wrong? But then a lot of it's focused on what happened on the internet. And you have these senior people in the American left who start asking, there's this new vocabulary they've never encountered. They've run campaigns for decades and they're saying, what are bot farms? What are troll armies? What are hack and dump operations? And they all find their way back eventually to this woman, Jory Craig. She's 25 years old. She's from Illinois. She was a Model UN nerd in high school who ends up at a firm in DC right after college called Greenberg Quinlan Ross. And through a sort of quirk of history, ends up having this huge overseas practice. Stan Greenberg, the firm's founding partner, had been Bill Clinton's pollster, Nelson Mandela, and Tony Blair's. So she's 22 years old and she's being sent to Moldova as a digital junior digital operative trying to help a parliamentary leader get on Facebook. And then she goes to Gabon and the Philippines and Panama and the Bahamas. And 2016 rolls around and she's not in the United States. She's following her home country's election from abroad. And afterwards, when people in Democratic politics want to know who to talk to about this stuff, they end up talking to her because she has the closest thing to an analogous experience. Because a lot of things that were new to us in American politics or seem new to us in American politics, are not new to politics. Foreign meddling in an election happens all over the world all the time by government business interests. The rise of partisan, ideologically affiliated media, I think we're grappling with this now. Certainly in the 19th century, the United States was shaped by a lot of this. In the 20th century, it largely was marginalized. The persistence of rumor and conspiracy theory is like just taken as a significant vector for political opinion and argument. And she had advised in huge parts of the world. And so she had advised campaigns in these environments how to make smart, strategic, and tactical decisions. And so what she was able to do when she came to the US was bring a sense of proportion to all this, which is people were overreacting, was her read. People were, I think, the novelty of the Russian engagement in 2016, melded with the technological novelty of people grappling with sort of social media still for in it in politics led folks to not use a normal set of sort of political calculations, which is what do I want to be talking about on a given day? And is this thing that my opposition wants to be talking about worth responding to? This is like comms 101 for people in politics. And people knew how to make those calculations if it was something on the front page of the newspaper or if it was something that your opponent said in a debate. Those were intuitive calculations for a lot of American political strategists. But as she told me, I quote her saying something like, because it came from the internet, people didn't know how to use their normal brains. And I think that there was this part of resistance era left thinking, which is like, oh my God, we need to do something. We need to do something about Trump. We need to do something about Russia. And that led, there was this sort of bias towards action or towards reaction when it came to disinformation online. And the basic fact is that it's often counterproductive to respond to somebody who's attacking you online, whether it's true or false. You drive attention to it. It feeds algorithms. It distracts you from what you want to be doing. And she was the person who could help campaigns think that about, but sometimes you do have to respond. And how do you get to the point where you can intelligently differentiate the signal from the noise in all of this?
It's really hard. And you can almost forgive political operatives who were weaned as a generation on the documentary, The War Room, George Stephanopoulos, rapid response, and political tomes like Chris Matthews' Hardball, which says, respond to every attack. Yeah. And you can see that kind of thinking. Even Obama, you highlight, had a fact-checking website informed in part by the smears about madrasas and is he really a secret Muslim that had cropped up in through 2008. In 2012, he has his own fact-checking website called Attack Watch, which was meant to democratize the process of fighting smears. But the real thing that you're focusing on here is this confluence of factors where you have the collapse of traditional media. You have institutions like Media Matters that are focused on, let's work the refs. The refs are the big traditional media outlets, which also function, not to sound like Sarah Palin, as filters. And Media Matters, their existence is around working the refs. And a lot of traditional responses from left-leaning campaigns and organizations are built on the same model of, let's work the refs, let's talk to the media, let's talk to the stations, let's get them to take smears down. And what Craig sees is, hold on, there are times you've got to do that, but there are times you definitely should not do that. And knowing the difference is worth something. And so she starts a practice, an entire political practice that's valuable around that. Part of that calculation is, and this is a piece that I still haven't sorted out to my own satisfaction. I'm trying to figure out, maybe you have figured out, is figuring out who the audience is for this type of stuff. Because it feels like a lot of the right-wing BS, be it from bots or trolls or Russians, as if there's a difference among those three, it feels like a lot of this stuff is built for by the right for the right. Yeah. And the hope is you're just trying to activate that group, get things circulating. Maybe you'll get some spillover to soft partisans or swing voters, or maybe you're just trying to troll the media and create enough conflict to create a story. What do you think the mechanism and the strategy is of all this stuff? How is it working? And it clearly is working somehow.
I think we should talk about all the, you're computing a strategic logic on to the creators. I think so much of what we, right-wing disinformation in the United States at least, is being created by the right for the right, not necessarily with any strategic goal of, it's form of expressive community building. This is something that Donald Trump sent a signal to his supporters in 2015 and 16, largely through the way that he used then Twitter primarily, which was, hey, whenever I think of something that I think is amusing, I'm going to put it out in the world. And whenever you people think of something amusing, I will amplify it. And I think that he, by retweeting, sharing basically DIY homemade content, whether they're people's quips or their memes or their GIFs or now slightly more sophisticated deepfake imagery, whatever it was, he helped foster a community that's around, it's incredibly creative. It's not wildly different than going to a quilting circle and everybody brings their quilt in that week, except the quilts are Hunter Biden GIFs. And if the head of the quilting circle likes it, he'll tell the whole world about it. And that has created an culture, a MAGA culture, a very online MAGA culture, where people try to outdo themselves, not through who can make the most door knocks or who can bundle the most money or sell the most lawn signs or some of the other metrics that other movements might have had for sort of volunteer supporter engagement, but where the measure of success is who can create the content that gets the most likes and shares. And, you know, some of that means that Sebastian Gorka or Don Jr. like it. And so they're not even creating it with the goal of moving opinions or even anything that should be described in a strategic language. They're just doing it to amuse themselves. And the challenge is that the opacity of the social internet makes it often very difficult to know how many people have seen something, to know, are those people, let's not even get to, are they persuadable voters in the districts or states that you care about? Are those people in the United States? Are those people 18 years old? Are those people? And so the underlying the sort of decision-making that Jori Craig is trying to, the sort of smart decision-making she's trying to inculcate in campaigns, is this big data problem, which is some platforms have some data. Twitter a few years ago had pretty good data. You could see what was moving on the platform with some comprehensiveness. Facebook offered some, and others were totally opaque. And TikTok's an extreme example now where, you know, something gets posted, it doesn't even have a permanent link, and you can do very little to follow where it goes. And so it makes the kind of intelligent decision making that somebody in a campaign headquarters would have made years ago about, okay, yeah, even if you think we don't respond to everything, we know if this hit ends up on the front page of the paper, we probably need to respond. If it's just on page 19 for now, let's not get distracted. We don't have a good framework. What I write about in the book is people trying to develop the tools to come up with a framework that can make good decisions where otherwise people had innate heuristics based on the old communication regime.
I think it is an incredibly hard kind of science problem to figure out. And then this is the essence of, in a way, what you wrote about in your earlier classic book, The Victory Lab, which is trying to figure out some causality, some link between this happens and then voters behave this way. And it's so difficult to parse what effect something is having. And for example, I wrote a piece in Washington Monthly last month in which I just pointed out that the biggest factor that's undersold among political analysts is how little Americans pay attention to everything, to the news and especially political news. And I quoted a pollster who ran a focus group suggesting that swing voters, as of a few years ago, were spending as little as 10 minutes a week, 0.1% of their time, absorbing news that involved politics. It's less than they spend brushing their teeth. And that's what leads to such incredibly low voter awareness about basic stories like, has Donald Trump been indicted on any felony counts? And about half of Americans don't know. They literally have heard nothing about this. And so I could tell myself a convincing story, kind of talking about your heuristics. I could tell myself a convincing story that, hey, you know, in an environment where in 1980, 45 million Americans watched the evening news, and today it's half that, it's 23 million, where you don't have these big centralized sources of information. If you can get a certain amount of volume of online crap happening, it's going to fill a vacuum and that's going to seep through. I could tell myself that story, but I don't know. And I could equally tell myself a story of, look, people's lack of information probably cuts both ways. That gets me to another issue that sort of jumped out for me from the book. First of all, quick aside, I want to give you a golf clap as a writer for getting something by or getting your editors to agree to something. You make this little tiny joke. You're talking about the Maine independent senator, Angus King, and you say he sits down with an operative at Burger King. And in parenthesis, you put No relation. How did you get your editor to agree to that?
Nobody ever caught it. I don't know. Editor, copy editor, proofreader. I was very proud of that joke.
Now, golf clap to you. It's just either your editor is also in on dad jokes or anyway, brilliant. A lot of what you're focused on here in the book is the straight up Russia bot troll disinformation, the malarkey machine, as you put it. And then there's more traditional right wing media, which is heavily slanted. I'm thinking Fox News here, but it's usually basically truthful, most of it. But then there's this kind of nebulous in between. And there's an awful lot of that kind of stuff out there too. And so it puts me onto this question of, think about PragerU. I've been focused a lot on PragerU recently, the right-wing YouTube-based video channel that puts out snappy five-minute videos on different issues. And they're very misleading, but they have the patina of being 101 level explainers on issues.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot that's in this gray area. How much are people like Jory Craig and the people you're following in the book, and how much are you thinking about that whole world of semi-disinformation, misinformation, BS-infused stuff that's online? Let's take a break. We'll be right back.
Yeah, so I think people see it as an ecosystem. And so the first thing that Jory Craig does when she has a client is she creates what she calls a landscape report. And the idea is to understand how information in a given area of the internet or moves. And this could be by subject matter, by geography. If she hires you and you're running for governor in Michigan, she will map the way Michigan-related news moves online. And that's a combination of traditional news sources, ideologically coded news sources, these dubious quote-unquote news sources, and some individuals, some of whom are people with real well-known names, and some of the people are just folks who are online presences that become nodes in these networks that move information. And what the goal of this exercise is, one, to begin to model how when stuff will make the jump. We talked about Trump supporters making content to amuse other Trump supporters. 99% of that never gets outside of the Reddit pages or 4chan or wherever they're spread, or Telegram groups or wherever they're spreading it that day. But 1% will say does. And probably of that, a very small fraction actually gets out to persuadable voters in a way that would make you care about its electoral impact. And so mapping what are the, if it gets to Charlie Kirk, that means it's more likely to then get to Fox News or get to the Daily Wire or some people that have major audiences, and figuring out the patterns of movement to understand which nodes are likely to. It's all about thinking about when stuff makes the jump, because a lot of those organizations, one assumes, are also being followed by people who are unlikely to be terribly persuadable. And so the concern is understanding when stuff moves out of that small sort of insular pond and gets to the bigger ocean where it can reach people. I think one of the big challenges, as you point out, is that I think one of the problems that there has been a tendency, especially among folks on the left who are worried about disinformation in the post-2016 era, to impute magical qualities to it. Mm. And people are rightfully, people who know anything about political communication, and even some people who don't know much about political communication, are appropriately skeptical of the ability of TV ads and direct mail and robocalls to move a voter's opinion, and certainly to move it in a way that holds. And we joke about this. My mailbox is filled with these stupid mailers. Who's ever going to change their vote based on this mailer? Oh my God, I'm getting bombarded by these ads. Who falls for this stuff, right? This is lay people say stuff like that, and then people who've read all of the empirical writing in political science on opinion formation say that. And yet, there are otherwise smart, thoughtful people who, you know, oh my God, this one thing went, Ben Shapiro retweeted this one thing, it's going to swing the election. And we should bring the same skepticism to, we should not assume that disinformation plays by a different set of rules. Everything we know about the ways in which a large portion of the electorate tunes out politics, does not make decisions until late. The small share of sort of low information, persuadable voters who decide late. We shouldn't assume that just because something's a lie, that it would move them in a way that we know political communication is unlikely to do. And I think that that's part of one of the challenges is right-sizing our expectation of the harm that something can do. And part of the way that I think it can be harmful is when it does get validated by more traditional political messengers. And so there are examples in the story I tell of stuff moving from what we would think of as the grassroots, the online grassroots to the elites, where stuff gets picked up by Donald Trump that started with Cat Turd or whoever. But then the other thing happens, which is I have a little towards the end on the episode about the IRA, the IRS hiring 88,000 new agents as a result of the Inflation Reduction Act. And that was largely started by elites, Republican senators, largely, who started saying stuff like this on the floor. And then it got picked up by Fox, and then it became widely accepted by, and that's a more traditional, I think, form of top-down communications cues. And so I think software moves both ways. And I think the crucial thing is mapping these patterns. One, the other thing, though, once Jory Craig has made these landscape analyses, yeah, one thing is to understand how information moves in these worlds. The other thing is to create a baseline for it. And so that you can start to understand, okay, is this out of the ordinary? The fact is that now we need to accept the fact that there are just huge parts of the internet that like traffic and lies and conspiracy theories all the time. And I think in the book, the example I use is people tell conspiracies about fluoride in the water supply every day. Is if you just drop in one day and see, oh my God, people on Reddit are going crazy with stuff about fluoride in the water, you would think we need to do something about this disinformation. Or is this just like the normal level of that people lie about fluoride in the water? And
right. Then you think about the fact that that is a joke. Right. It was a joke in Dr. Strangelove, right?
Yeah, you can't make that decision. Yeah.
Exactly. So this is literally, what, an 80-year-old joke. And so this kind of puts me on to, boy, this is a dot connection that I'm not sure you're going to appreciate, because okay. I'm going to try and put you into your Victory Lab brain while you're in Lie Detective's brain.
Yeah.
One of the things that really resonated with me from the Victory Lab, which if people are listening to this podcast, you're smart. You're into politics. Read the Victory Lab. It's great. One of the things that really resonated with me was your observation. This is not rocket surgery. It's well known, but it's really important that one of the problems that parties as institutions face, let's call it the Democratic Party for our purposes here, the institutional left, is that campaigns are so ephemeral. And the name of your final chapter is the permanent campaign. But in reality, campaigns are very short-term enterprises, and they do a lot of reinventing wheels. And that was one of your key points, is that they're very bad at trying new stuff, at innovating. And it strikes me that they're also very bad at combating this whole miasma of misinformation and disinformation and quasi-BS. And in fact, you really need a permanent large-scale apparatus that is focused from the left that's thinking about this. And even Jory Craig works for a particular political consulting firm. And there are the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. You profile how they try to start up an effort around this. There are arms of the party that are thinking about this and working on this. But do you see, is there that more permanent response strategy and infrastructure in place, or are these institutions, are these folks still playing catch up and in a scattershot way?
Yeah. So I write about how the left created this sort of tracking, sharing infrastructure, and starting in 2019, the idea that, so partially so as not to the coordinated campaign model in a forum, but the idea of to not have duplicative efforts. At this point, it was Jory Craig was at Greenberg, Quinlan Rosner, and her team was doing this. But if we're tracking what's on the internet, why not have one place that can be funded by one central source and figure out how through campaign finance law to share it on the hard side and then separately on the soft side, so that everybody is looking at the same landscape documents that we're talking about, has the same basis, looking at the same data sets, has the same basis on which to make these decisions, so that in part because of the imperfect information that you want to make sure that everybody's on the same page. And so that has become a sort of part of year in, year out, part of the infrastructure of the American left now. I think they understand that there are particular needs you have in an election cycle, but that it has advocacy groups that benefit from this, groups that are doing stuff, they're focused on the legislative calendar and recognize that you can't just turn this on and turn it off. Now, I think if you're thinking about this in the long term, will there be cycles of investment and disinvestment or attention or lack of attention, depending on who's in power and what the sense of threat is and all that? Yeah, it might be. And you might get to the point where people said the same thing about voter files, that this needs to be a permanent investment. And then guess what? Party committees change and donors move in and out of what they think is cool that year. And it becomes very hard. Everybody tunes in the even numbered year and then decides that their money can do something else. So I'm not sure. I wouldn't say this will hold forever, but I think the thinking right now on the left is an understanding that this is a fundamentally different communications challenge than what campaigns used to think, which is if you thought of your opposition as your opponent, then they were working under the same calendar you were. So if you didn't announce your campaign until January of the election year, you assumed your opponent was too, and you didn't have to have your rapid response team up before your opponent was going to communicate against you. You need your war room to be doing whatever they're doing until your opponent was. But if you see this as there is a sort of permanent, durable information infrastructure that will be communicating about you and the issues you care about in and out of an election season, you need to be tracking it in and out of an election season. You can't just assume, because that's the fundamental asymmetry of this moment, is that your opposition isn't your opponent. And so you can't assume that they're playing under the same calendar or the same campaign finance rules, all the things that kind of guide how and when they make decisions. And that is something that has been recognized, I think, on the left now.
Let's bring this full circle. I think we started off with potentially the biggest story in the world and mostly a bad news story. And I mentioned sort of Tim Snyder's rundown of, hey, the biggest issues we're dealing with are based on misinformation, disinformation, propaganda, foreign entities. And we're talking about Ukraine. We even have Ken Buck, the right-wing congressman, calling his fellow member of Congress, right-wing Marjorie Taylor Greene, Moscow Marjorie, because she is stenographically repeating Vladimir Putin's propaganda. You have that degree of infiltration of disinformation into American government. So the situation is clearly very dangerous and very bad. On the other hand, there are some pieces of good news. Facebook is essentially removing politics. They're not entirely, but to a large degree, they're removing their institutional support for political content. I'm interviewing next week, as a programming note for our listeners, Paul Farhi from The Atlantic, who just had a fascinating piece on how traffic to right-wing news sites is down substantially, much more than traffic for left-leaning and centrist sites. Maybe that's a little bit of a breadcrumb there. But technology is probably moving faster than our ability to regulate around it, respond to it, keep up with it. There's AI, there's deepfakes, there's all kinds of stuff that we haven't even thought of yet. So having taken the most comprehensive look at this of anyone out there today, how discouraged or encouraged do you feel about the work of the lie detectives and trying to fight disinformation?
I think pretty discouraged in the short term. I think everybody thinks that 24 is going to be a bad year for this for a bunch of the reasons you mentioned. I think the flip side of platforms saying that we're de-emphasizing politics as part of that is cover to not do content moderation work on stuff that is on their platforms. And I think that the trends in the tech business are towards disinvestment and pulling away from that, which 5 years ago, the pendulum was swinging in another direction. They all felt like at least they needed to put on a show of taking this seriously. I'm not sure that is an inevitable downward narrative. I think that we've been through a few cycles of this already, driven by how much companies fear regulation in Congress, how much they see the political advertising market is valuable to them relative to other revenue sources, how much they care about the PR hit that they take when newspapers write about what's moving on their platform. And I don't think it would take a whole lot of change in our political environment on any of those fronts to be in a world where 2 years from now, Facebook is, maybe it's another charismatic candidate for president like Obama, when all the tech companies were saying, oh, we want to be a place for politics. We're great for civic engagement. We want to partner with all the get out the vote drives and registration programs, and we want to be the town square. I don't, you know, there could be that. There could be some sort of move in Congress or shift in congressional control that makes them fear certain types of regulation. I don't, if they could recognize that the political ad market is significant enough in their sort of profit loss world to think that pulling away from politics isn't worth the economic hit. Anyway, I think that those things in a year, 2 years, 3 years could swing in all sorts of directions and could end up pushing the companies to do more within their power to moderate content on their platforms. I also would, one note of caution on the AI stuff, I think we're right to come up with all sorts of scenarios about how people will be confused by deep fakes, but I think there is a sort of, often people get distracted by the new technology and lose sight of what you were saying earlier, which is, this is about hacking people. And we have at the moment a very gullible public in the United States and in many of our peer countries. And some of the most successful, I think, disinformation projects in the United States over the last 7-8 years have been not high tech in the least bit. They've been, I would think of a sort of series of conspiracy theories that have really transformed our politics, QAnon, coronavirus-related disinformation, and the post-2020 election, January 6th. And none of those were grounded in any high-tech deception, right? QAnon started as literally ASCII text on a bulletin board. It wasn't like anybody used some really sophisticated deepfake technology to pretend Pfizer was doing something with its RCTs. They, in the 2020 election stuff, was started basically by one blowhard at a microphone. And, but in every case, they preyed on existing anxieties, a lack of kind of countervailing authorities in American society, and told people stories that they wanted to believe and helped trigger a community and culture around them. And so I think if we see this as, I think we need to see this more as a demand side problem, which is, why are people receptive to these types of, especially these totalizing conspiracy theories, and how do you deal with that rather than having a mindset where we think it's about chasing whatever's moving that day and worried that new technology is going to make the content like marginally more convincing. And in that front, I don't think there's a lot of reason to be optimistic in the shorter near term.
Look, maybe you could take advantage of it, and your next book could be The Secret Family History, linking the Burger King and Angus King. You could really cash out on that. In the meantime, you deserve, I don't know about cash out, but you deserve to get as much readership as you possibly can for The Lie Detectives. Look, The Victory Lab has been widely praised as the handbook chronicling the advances in technology that reshaped modern American elections campaigning. I think that this book has just as much of a chance as being seen as a seminal work in understanding what is one of the issues of our time. It's fantastic. I hope people will go out and buy it. I'll put the link. I'm going to put the Amazon link. Yay, big capitalism. I'm going to put the Amazon link right in the show notes here. And Sasha Eisenberg, thanks so much for being with us.
Really appreciate it, man. Good talking to you. Thanks.